history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are indeed stories there, untold stories that should not remain untold. You never know what we might hear when we ask a few questions and take the time to listen. The idea here is to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And you know, we always come out ahead because we're educated, we're entertained, often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. This weekend marks the 75th anniversary of VJ Day, Victory Over Japan, and the end of hostilities in World War II. A decade ago, Congress officially made August 14th Spirit of 45 Day in an effort to remind us all of that spirit of unity, of relief, of freedom that existed in America and the world once that long global conflict had ended. Spirit of 45 observations are happening all over the country this weekend, and we'll have our own version of that here on the radio. Of course, Japan did not formally surrender until September 2nd, 1945, when those papers were signed aboard the battleship USS Missouri in Tokyo Bay. The Missouri is now in Pearl Harbor, of course, and that will be the site of a special commemoration when that anniversary rolls around in a couple weeks. I'm giving you a heads up now so you can plan on watching a live stream online on September 2nd if you go to hometownheroesradio.com. I have a link for you to the organization that's putting all of that on. It's the 75th commemoration of the end of World War II. Veterans who were on the Missouri 75 years ago are going to be there. The Secretary of Defense and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff will speak. World War II warbirds will be flying over. It's going to be something that's really worth tapping into. So put that on your calendar for September 2nd. We're going to hear how different veterans experienced VJ Day in different parts of the world today, but it was so meaningful for all the civilians back home as well. For 4 years, they'd been all in on the war effort, women going to work so men could fight overseas, Americans young and old sacrificing daily in the hope that freedom would be preserved. So that news of victory was significant enough to set up celebrations all over the United States. The most famous scene was in New York's Times Square, and if you'd been listening to NBC Radio that day, you would have heard a report from Ben Grauer that rivals the best sports play by play announcers ever in terms of how he described that exuberant scene.
This is the NBC mobile unit in the heart, center, and the pulsing focus of a joyous nation on Times Square in New York City. Ben Grauer reporting as I stand, literally stand, tiptoe, sticking my head outside the silver gray turret top of the NBC mobile unit and look uptown over a foaming, seething, writhing mass of faces lifted joyously and buoyantly and gloriously happy at the final conclusion of a desperate war which has seen its closing days in a desperate day or three or four of anxiety, turmoil, anticipation, doubt, fear, and being cast down. Are these people happy? That's the only word to express it. Are you happy? And all I need to do is turn my NBC microphone down over these folks here and to see this wave of smiles, confetti, streamers, banners, bells, jingles, flags, horns, and a joyous, buoyant, glorious look on everybody's face. If I can calm down for just a minute, I'd like to take this scene apart to see that here we have a combination of every type and person in the country represented by these people here. I can see by the looks on the faces that there's a person from out of town, from the West Coast, from Kansas, from Miami, from Oakland, California. There's a serviceman from the... Oh, they won't let me talk. The reason for that is that a daring Marine has just leaped upon a representation of the picture of the flag being planted on the peak of Mount Suribachi in Iwo Jima and has raised a little but gloriously defiant American flag. And in victory, this little piece of bunting is going up to the top of the Iwo Jima. And now here's a sailor on the other side of this lamppost, which says Times Square Broadway, and he has been kissed close by the grape and by a beautiful girl because he climbed up that lamppost, a about 25, 30 feet high. Now he's in his own little crow's nest here in the heart of Manhattan, and he's waving a happy and joyous hello to everyone below him. He's got a rose stuck in his little pocket over his left breast, just above his campaign ribbons, and he's waving his hat happily in the air. Up above, I see nothing but a sea, a rolling mass of faces conspicuously marked by the white headgear of Navy boys. And down right here close to us, a quick glance at the massing, milling crowd would indicate that there's approximately 20% of servicemen. I think that's a fair estimate. They have been drawn to this, the focus and heart of New York City, and which expresses at this moment the pent-up jubilation and joy and relief after 4 years of war. Oh, he's made it! The sailor boy got to the very top of the lamppost and then reached the most precarious peak, and he's sitting right now on a representation of the seal of the city of New York. And he doesn't care if anybody knows it. Joy, glamour, beauty, excitement, and overall an expression of tremendous relief. I see also mixed in the crowd those who are silent, mostly older people, many of them perhaps people who will carry the memory of a loved one who hasn't returned, whose sacrifice is continuous. I see many people who are sitting standing mouth agape. The thing is so overwhelming that they can't express it in their own jubilation and just much others. There's a little gray-haired lady with a happy smile, somewhat toothless, but all over her face, and I see that she's got a service button with two stars on it. Our congratulations and joy to you, madam. And here's a little girl, a bobby soxer, if ever I saw one. And she's kissing a sailor right next to her. The sailors seem to be having the most of it. There's a girl with brimming black eyes, and she is smiling and kissing a soldier. The army has taken over for a moment here. And now the policeman, Mayor LaGuardia's representatives here, in a very kindly and understanding and sympathetic way, are trying to keep the crowd back who are pressing around this lamppost. And now the Marine is cast. A Marine's going up to challenge the Navy man up there. This, and ladies and gentlemen, is NBC's description from Times Square of a part of the VJ celebration in New York City. Ben Grau speaking and returning to you to the NBC newsroom in New York.
If you weren't alive in 1945, and I know I wasn't, that really gives you a feel for just how significant the news of victory over Japan was to everybody in America, young and old, 75 years ago this week. Among that sea of humanity in Times Square was a young Chinese-American merchant mariner named Murray Lee.
I was in Times Square when the Japanese surrendered.
That must have been interesting.
It was, because you know that we have that famous Kiss statue. Yeah. Here in San Diego? Well, I was there when that was going on, and I remember all these guys doing that, and of course, I was too bashful to go and grab a girl, you know, that I didn't know and kiss her. But I saw all these guys doing that, these Navy guys, and everybody was celebrating that. My friend and I did meet a couple of girls, and they said, oh, you want to go walk into Central Park or something with us? And I said, okay, we'll go and take a look at that. And so that was kind of interesting period, but we were very fortunate that was the end of hostilities, but it wasn't the end of danger, because when we were out in the Atlantic, we had to watch out for floating mines, because it was going up to Antwerp, and that we had a minesweeper going ahead of us. They had me go on the bow one time. They said, why don't you go do look out on a bow? And I said, look out on a bow? If we had a mine, that's the first place it's going to blow up, right?
Thankfully, that didn't happen. Murray Lee is a treasure who's done so many things to preserve history in San Diego, where he lives. And if you'd like to listen to his complete original interview about his service in World War II, you can find it at hometownheroesradio.com. As this episode goes on, we'll hear other examples of danger that servicemen would find themselves on and after VJ Day. You heard NBC's report from Times Square, but if you were listening to CBS radio that night, you would have heard a dramatic interpretation of what America and the world had been through, voiced by the one and only Orson Welles.
This day is the father of great anniversaries. Men and saints shall picnic together on 14 August, down more years than you or I shall see. So say it tonight with saluting guns. Say it with roses. Say it with a hand clasp, a drink, a prayer. Say it any way you want, but say it! Say it!
Mm-hmm.
Columbia Broadcasting System presents 14 August, a message for the day of victory by Norman Corwin, spoken by Orson Welles.
Congratulations for being alive and listening on this night. Millions didn't make it. They died before their time, and they are gone and gone. For the fascists got them. They are not here, but their acts are here. And they are to be saluted from the lips and from the heart before the conversation swings around to reconversion. Fire a cannon to their everlasting memory. God and uranium were on our side. The wrath of the atom fell like a commandment, and the very planet quivered with implications. Tokyo Rose was hung over from the news next day, and the emperor prayed to himself for succor. So sound the guns for Achilles, the atom, and the war workers, Newton and Galileo, Curie and Einstein, the Archangel Gabriel, and the community of Oak Ridge, Tennessee. Ladies and gentlemen, the peoples have come a long way since we were tadpoles. Much has happened, and the upward path has been strewn with dinosaurs, tigers, Caesars, slave traders, and fascists, in spite of which, as you have heard on the radio tonight, the best in the way of flags is flying over the once mighty lands of the enemy, and free men are being born on schedule. New free men, conceived December last, during a counteroffensive against their elders in the Ardennes, are tonight breathing and kicking and making fists, our heirs to victory. Whereas the saber-toothed tiger is nicely arranged with fish fossils in the museum, and Caesar is twice hacked to pieces by his countrymen, the second time strung up by the heels to cure. The trader in slaves cannot buy back his name from the contempt of the generations, and the Nazi is parted from his pomp and his Führer, pending announcement of the hanging day. The Jap, who never lost a war, has lost a world, learning at what cost to us all, but crime does not pay. This too is worth a cheer.
An excerpt from 14 August, a dramatic presentation voiced by Orson Welles 75 years ago. You can access that in its entirety at hometownheroesradio.com. Right now, it's time for our first break, but when we come back, more memories of VJ Day as our servicemen and women experienced it around the world 75 years ago this week. For some, it was exhilarating. For others, tragic. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons Citizens EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special VJ Day edition 75 years after the Allies finally received that commitment to surrender from Imperial Japan. What a relief it was to men, women, and children all over the globe, but especially for those who had been in captivity. One of the most well-known prisoner of war stories from the Pacific War is that of Louis Zamperini, the Olympian turned airman turned POW, who inspired the bestseller Unbroken by Laura Hillenbrand and the blockbuster film of the same name. Louis's time in captivity saw him starved and tortured, especially by a Japanese guard nicknamed the Bird. But the way he realized the war was over was something he could never forget.
It was a beautiful day. We were suspicious. You see, there's always rumors the war's over, so we didn't believe anything. But this one guard came to me and he said, a horrible thing happened in a city called Hiroshima. A cholera broke out, and nobody can communicate with Hiroshima. And I thought, cholera, my God, how horrible. I'm glad we're hundreds of miles north. But that was the first atomic bomb, and the Japanese lied to the public. Mm-hmm. But then when the second bomb was dropped, they told the truth immediately because they had no choice. So that ended the war, and then a plane flew over, and we wrote PW on the roof. They circled left. And then the Bird disappeared. He knew the war was over before we did. He skipped out and hid out in the mountains for 10 or 12 years. In the meantime, a TBF flew over from a carrier and sent us the Morse code in red light, that the war was over. And we were in the river for the first time swimming. We always wanted to go in that fresh water to clean ourselves. They wouldn't let us do it. Mm. But then the day they let us do it, I thought, well, maybe the war is over. And so anyway, we came out of there, and the TBF dropped a long red streamer, and we picked it up, and on the end was a candy bar with a bite out of it and a pack of cigarettes with one cigarette missing. We had to divide both of those up with several hundred men. Mm. We had to form circles, and one cigarette. Everybody takes one puff, and so it goes around the circle. It was really funny, but we were serious. And then the chocolate, we got a little teeny sliver just to taste it. And that was it. Now, Commander Fitzgerald of the Perch submarine, he was in command, the highest ranking officer with us, and he made sure that everybody got one puff of cigarette and a little taste of the chocolate. And then, of course, the B-29s came over and dropped tons of food on us. And instead of hating the guards, they were complaining about their families starving at home. So we gave them a lot of food from the bombers.
Well, your stomachs probably couldn't take that much anyway.
Well, the thing is, the commander warned the guys, you know, you haven't been eating good food. You've been eating seaweed and barley for years, and so take it easy on the food. Well, some guys were so hungry, they just, pea soup was supposed to be diluted with a can of water, and they would eat it straight. So some guys got diarrhea from that, but the smart guys just ate a little bit. A little more every day until they got used to it. Yeah, I went to hell and almost got killed on the way home. You know, there was a bomber. We were supposed to fly to Manila, but socked in. I'm leaving Okinawa now. I'm gradually working my way home. And we were told to land at Loag, a small city in northern Luzon, on a fighter strip. Stayed there all night. Next day, they gave us clearance to go to Manila. And we took off with this bomber full of about 40 prisoners inside. And the runway's too short. There was a berm on the end of the runway that they put there to keep the ocean from flooding the runway. And I was up there between the pilot and co-pilot, and I knew we weren't going to make it, and they did too. We hit the berm, bounced in the air, and settled so low that the white caps came through the bomb bay doors and got all the prisoners wet. And I thought, this is it. After all I've been through, I'm dead. And then the plane gradually pulled up. We got to Manila. Now, a couple of years ago, I got a call from a fellow in the East, and he asked me how I got to Manila. When I told him about that bomber taking off, he said, well, I was the pilot, and I almost went in my pants. So, yeah. Anyway, that's really funny. Yeah, so anyway, I got home, and of course, big celebrations, and I had a ball, and then I finally got married.
You probably know the rest of that story. If you don't, pick up Unbroken and read it, or link to Louis's interview at hometownheroesradio.com. He gave you a feel of what it was like for a prisoner, but how about being one of those pilots delivering aid to men who were about to experience freedom again? One of the men who can tell that story is PBM pilot Irvin Cooper.
The war was winding down, and we heard about the atomic bomb. Strangely enough, the Japanese military would not give up. They were determined, and they had every man, woman, and child in Japan told them, when the Americans invade, whatever you do, you try to kill somebody. Little kids with sticks, stones, guns, whatever they could have. I was at a place called Ulithi, and I saw 5,000, I'm using the word 5,000 because I don't know how to describe it anymore, of ships of every kind, from battleships, cruisers, to tankers, to ships holding supplies, water, men, and all that ready to invade, a million men ready to invade Japan. And they were just standing by. And the atomic bomb went off, and the Japanese said, no, we're not going to do it again. So they did the second atomic bomb, which was at Nagasaki. And I understand the Japanese generals and all still refused. It was Hirohito himself who stepped in and said that enough is enough. But had they invaded, they would have lost, I don't know how many men they would have lost, but they would have lost millions of Japanese people too at the same time. Anyway, the bomb went off and we heard about it. And we were on a patrol, just a general patrol, whatever things were left over and stuff. And we were flying along. They gave us an assignment to go to, and I don't remember the name, prisoner of war camp, where a group of Australians were all in captive. And when I went to the plane, instead of having bombs on it, we were loaded with chocolate, with supplies for toothbrushes, teeth, oh, everything you can imagine, care packages galore, and little parachutes. And when you get over there, I want you to drop this stuff over there. So that was our mission. As we were going along, I think I was flying, and Amos was the navigator at the time. He says, hey, we're only about a half hour from Nagasaki. So we were free, and we flew over and got to Nagasaki. There was two valleys there. Japan is so green and beautiful from the sky. I remember flying along the coast and saying, I got to bring Elaine back to see this. This is unbelievable. The agriculture from the top of a little mountain down to the bottom was all just immaculately done. And we go over this beautiful valley, and the other side was completely browned out, like you could see streets in there and nothing. It was a concrete building that was sagging in the middle of it. And we flew around that thing. And sitting in the plane, I was holding, as we did, we were holding our crotch, if you'll excuse us, because we heard of this word we'd never heard of before. Radiation. What kind of word is that? Never heard of a thing like, well, it's the radiation will come. If it hits you, you won't have kids. You won't have anything. So here we are flying with our hand over our crotch, our hand on the wheel, and we're tipping around flying. We better get the hell out of here. So, and we took some pictures of it there, and we left Nagasaki. We flew over the Japanese camp. Apparently, the people that ran the camp, the Japanese soldiers or whatever, they just took off and left the prisoners there. And we dropped our supplies, and I have a picture of the prisoners coming out, taking off their shirts or whatever they had, and they wrote thanks on the ground that you can see. So that was quite an event.
PBM pilot Irvin Cooper remembering the end of the war in the Pacific 75 years ago this week. You can link to his complete original interview at hometownheroesradio.com, where you'll also find a two-part conversation with Bill Overmeyer. Bill had been captured on Corregidor near the start of the war in the Pacific. VJ Day meant he would be a free man again.
One day after work, the commandant, who was, we found out that he was a principal at the high school, and he spoke a little English.
Uh-huh.
And we went into the mess hall, just the officers and the non-commissioned officers. And he got up in front, he said, peace is smiling. We say, what'd you say? Peace is smiling, goo. The war is over, goo. Hallelujah. That place went up in smoke. He said, don't tell the men. Keep it quiet, please. We said, yes, we will. Until we got out the door. And we told everybody else as quick as we could.
How do you keep that news to yourself, right?
Anyway, then here came B-29s. What the heck are they doing this close? Oh, they're dropping parachutes. Oh, that's a 55-gallon drum. Oh, it dropped right in the rice field right outside our camp. A camp of 55 drums of cocoa, 55 drums of sugar, lard, anything else. And, boy, we started eating like you can't believe. I slept next to Cy Serrata. He was in the 31st Infantry at Yokohama. Right, I could touch him every night on a straw mattress. And he had gone with us, of course. He was up on a roof. One of those 55 guns hit him on the head.
Oh.
Survived 3 years, and he got, at least he didn't suffer.
They're dropping supplies to try to keep you alive, and it kills him on the roof.
The chute didn't open.
Wow.
That didn't happen very often, but it did happen.
How tragic.
But it did happen. I think I was lucky. I was fortunate in the outcome of everything that happened. Mainly, I didn't stick my neck out. We had a saying in camp, don't stick your ears out or anything out and do anything contrary to what the Japs don't like or do like. So that's what happened. And I didn't, you know, the Army term for seeking approval from a higher up. We didn't do that.
Yeah. I know exactly what you're talking about.
Anyway, we did what we had to do to survive. And you just take it day by day. I learned at Yokohama how little it takes to survive, to live, day after day. You need food. That's a question mark. You need a roof over your head. You need clothes to survive against the elements, and maybe friendship. There wasn't that much of it, but books or peace of mind that you could manufacture or whatever. That's about all you need. You don't need all this fancy living. When we were liberated from Sendai, we got on the train. And we got the same train that brought us down, and we went up to Yokohama train station. We'd passed it every day, twice. And there was American soldiers, officers, and nurses. We saw our first American nurses and workers and so forth. They sure look good, I'll tell you.
Things that could easily be taken for granted no longer were for those who had survived in captivity, not knowing if they'd ever taste freedom again. And the way the news of Japan's surrender was communicated worked out a little differently depending on where prisoners were being held. George Heimbuch had questioned whether he would make it through and whether he would ever see his brother Ray, who was also a prisoner in a different camp.
We took over our own camp when we found out that interpreters said that there was a truce. Well, we knew there was no truce. We knew it was over.
Right.
So we took over the camp, and we went out on forays, you know.
Yeah, I hear you even stole a train full of sake at one point, which is a story in itself.
Yeah, we got a truckload of sake in those in the 5-gallon jugs, you know, with those straw around it. They loaded the truck up. Two guys found it. I didn't find it. Two other guys found it. But they brought it into camp, and we had all canteens filled with it when we went on the train. They said, this train don't go to Yokohama. And Papinello said, yeah. He said, you get ready to go to Yokohama because that's where we're going. And you know, he was on the key, you know, and they they took us into Yokohama, right?
You're liberated, and you're thinking, I'm going to get to go home, and I'll find out at some point if my brother's still alive or not, if he made it through the war as a POW. And tell me about how you bumped into him.
Well, we were in a tent. All of us were in tents, and I asked around, and nobody knew anything about my brother. Mm-hmm. And they had a staging area that where they announced guys that were going to leave that day. So every morning at 4, I'd get up and go down there, see if they announced his name, see? And he did the same thing, see if they announced my name. And there was a ditch there full of water, and they had a plank across it. And one morning I went down there, and it was raining, it was pretty miserable. I come back, and I stepped on that plank, and somebody was on the other end. And I said, excuse me, and I stepped off, and he said, George, it was my brother.
The guy that you asked to get off the plank was your brother.
Yeah.
I imagine that was a pretty big hug right about then.
Yeah, that was a big meeting. Yeah, we had a good time there.
A reunion made possible by the Allied victory in the Pacific secured 75 years ago this week. It's time for our final break, but when we come back, he wrote a book called The Last Fighter Pilot. On August 14th, 1945, he was in the air in his P-51, and his wingman never made it home. Remember, you can link to full-length interviews with any of the veterans you're hearing from today at hometownheroesradio.com, and our 75th anniversary VJ Day edition comes down the home stretch right after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com and tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Loeffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special episode marking 75 years since VJ Day, victory over Imperial Japan after Emperor Hirohito declared his intent to surrender to Allied forces. It would become official 19 days later aboard the USS Missouri, and that 75th anniversary will be marked September 2nd at Pearl Harbor. Put that on your calendar and plan on picking up the live stream that day. One little-known detail about what was happening 75 years ago this week is that there was actually a conspiracy among leading Japanese military minds to intercept the emperor and prevent him from surrendering. Ultimately, it was foiled because American B-29s were flying over Tokyo and a blackout was imposed. You may hear more about that in one of our upcoming episodes. American fighters and bombers were still flying missions on August 14, 1945, and preparations for the invasion of Japan were also moving forward. Dick Lyon, a Southern California native who had been an Olympic-caliber swimmer at Yale, would later become the first Navy SEAL to reach the rank of admiral. But the Navy SEALs did not exist 75 years ago. He was part of the Scouts and Raiders, one of the original frogmen, and a reconnaissance mission to a potential landing spot near a small Japanese village brought him a unique encounter, not to mention a set of keepsakes he treasured until his passing.
Off we went to Japan, and I did another recon on a beach in a little city on Honshu, the big island, actually a village, really. Same thing. Good beach. Having gone in, done the beach, and was ready to come out and be picked up by my LCVP, the Landgraft, and get back onto the APA. And I noticed that the little city, as you might expect, right at the end of the war, little village looked deserted. I mean, really, nobody. And as I looked, I observed three men, elderly, I could tell, my face mask on top of my head by that point, and I'm looking, and they came right down to the edge of the water, and I'm in the water up to about my shoulders, and I looked at them, and they looked at me. The man in the middle said, I can see what you have just completed doing, and I understand what is happening. It's easy to see that a small landing will take place, relatively small, and I presume that this is being done all over our homeland. I want you to know that we will cooperate in any way that we can to make this peaceful and help in any way that we can to be sure that there are no additional casualties of any kind. And would you please be sure to pass this word to your superiors so that they know that there will be no opposition whatsoever. And of course, I was just astounded that, wait a minute, all in perfect English? I thought, after a pause, I said, I certainly will do that. And by the way, here in this little village, he kind of straightened up a little bit and he said, well, I must let you know, I achieved my undergraduate baccalaureate degree from Harvard University. I couldn't let that one go. And then I just paused for literally 5 or 10 seconds, saying nothing. And I just looked at him, didn't say anything. And then I said, well, I have to tell you, I'm a Yalie. And we used to kick Harvard butt regularly on the football field. We both laughed, and as it turned out, he invited me to join, he and his wife, and I ran it by my boss, who said, this is a golden opportunity for you. He, by all means, go in, have dinner with them, and enjoy. He said, in whatever way, I think he kind of is the leader of what's left in this little place, and we need that cooperation. So I did that, and I went in armed with 2 cartons of Lucky Strike cigarettes. they were more than gold bars. They were, and he was just delighted to receive those. And after dinner, I got back to get my way back on the APA. And as I was leaving, he said, I want you to have this. And he handed me a portfolio of 23 appliqué pictures, if you will, done by hand, appliqué, and then in the characters on the pictures, a story of how each of those persons became a samurai warrior. And so those samurai warriors are now adorning the wall behind me. You look right over my shoulder. You can see those, and I got those in 1945.
I can't imagine how mind-boggling that was to have that conversation on the beach. And just so people understand, you made it sound very mundane, these recon missions. Yeah, there's a good gradient. It was a good beach. But tell us how you did it. You mentioned your face mask and all that. Tell us what kind of equipment you had. Were you by yourself? Is this in the middle of the night in a rubber boat? Or were you just free swimming? How did this work?
Well, definitely free swimming. I went in. I have a lead line with which I would take the soundings, and a slate on which I would record the soundings and an indication where there might have been any natural or man-made obstacles. My uniform was a pair of swim trunks and swim fins. Do you remember the Churchill swim fins? You may recall those. No. They were a different shape, and that's where ultimately the Navy's underwater demolition teams became known in the Navy as frogmen, because with those swim fins on, why, you're the closest thing to looking like a frog as you could get. That was pretty much a face mask. I never went in the water without my K-bar, which is a knife, which was I had strapped on my lead belt. That's pretty much the uniform.
Another one of those things that has changed just a bit over the years. That was the late Admiral Dick Lyon. After he retired from the Navy, he entered politics, and for 8 years, they called him mayor of Oceanside, California. For Jerry Yellen, the last fighter pilot is a moniker he often heard. That was the title of one of his books, focusing on the mission he flew in his P-51 Mustang on August 14, 1945. When he returned from that mission, the war was over, but one of his best friends, his wingman, Phil Schlomberg, had been killed in action. Yellen spent his final years as an outspoken advocate for the Spirit of 45 campaign, hoping that every year at this time, American leaders of the future would be inspired through reminders of the spirit of unity and belief that prevailed in America 75 years ago.
My wish for the Spirit of 45 is to reach out to all the young people in America to make our stories known of what made us the greatest generation. We served, 16 million of us served, 10% of the population, but the other 90% were also. We had an identifiable enemy. Japan was our enemy. Germany declared war on America. We never declared war on Germany, but that made the war, Germany and Japan. And after it was over, the leaders of America rebuilt Japan and rebuilt Germany so that we have allies of those who were formerly enemy. In 1988, my youngest son, a four son, married the daughter of a kamikaze pilot in Japan. And I have three Japanese grandchildren. They mean as much to me as my three American grandchildren.
When your son had proposed to his wife, she had to talk to her father because her father was a Japanese fighter pilot in World War II, right?
Yes, he was a kamikaze pilot. He had four or five hours in a zero, and his whole class of flymates, of classmates, were sent into the war as kamikaze pilots, but he and one other guy were sent to China, and he survived the war. In 1983, I was asked by the Mitsui Bank Group to go to Japan, talk about real estate in America. I was a consultant to the major banks in San Diego and San Francisco. And I didn't want to go in 1983. Japan was not a place I visit, and Japanese weren't human beings. They weren't people. But my wife wanted to go, so we went to Japan. And I immediately fell in love with the culture, the food, the people. So when we came back in 1983, we offered a homestay program to our youngest son, who was a senior in college. He graduated from college in 1984, didn't know what he wanted to do, so he took a job teaching English for 1 year. Now it's 2014, and he hasn't come back yet. In 1987, we went to Japan, and I met a young lady, and Robert said that he wanted to get married to her. And I saw the faces of the 16 guys that were killed that I knew in my squadron. And I wondered what they would think, but it was not my life. It was his life that was important. And I asked him, what does her father say? And he said he won't meet me. And 7 months later, the father did meet my son. And he had full beard, bushy hair. And the father asked him just five questions. How old is your father? 63. Was he in the war? Yes. What did he do? He's a pilot. What did he fly? He said P-51s. He said, where? Over Japan. And he went home, said to his wife, make the wedding. And she said, why? We hate them. And he said, any man that could fly a P-51 against the Japanese and live must be a brave man. And I want the blood of that man to flow through the veins of our grandchildren. So I have three grandchildren in Japan. And we went there in September of 2012 to talk to them as adults. My oldest grandson's name is Kentaro. We call him Ken. And he has a job. He just graduated from the Hokkaido University, which is the technical school similar to MIT, as a physicist with a master's degree in physics, and was one of 20,000 applicants for 100 jobs. And he got one of the 100 jobs. His brother last year graduated from the University of City of London, a four-year course in 3 years, as a philosopher, and the last 2 years of the school, he studied in Latin, which was the language spoken by the ancient philosophers. And when he graduated on the dean's list, got an A-plus on his dissertation, and was awarded a 2 years master's program scholarship at Oxford. So he just started Oxford University. So I guess that other guy, the other father, knew something that I didn't know, and it happens to be right. It turned out he was right. And then I have a 17-year-old granddaughter. We don't know what she's going to do, but the two boys are absolutely outstanding.
But neither one of them would be here if both their grandfathers hadn't survived World War II.
That's true. I met, for the first time, a member of Phil Schlomberg's family. Phil Schlomberg was my wingman, who was killed on August 14th, 1945, on the last mission flown over World War II.
And you guys were P-51s, and he was a good friend of yours and was flying on your wing, but he had somewhat of a premonition about that mission, didn't he?
Phil Schlomberger, we were briefing on August 13th, and somebody asked, why are we going there? They dropped two bombs, the war's over. And Jim Tapp was our then CO, and he said, we have to keep him honest. And Schlomberg leaned over and he said, Captain, if we go, I'm not coming back. And I looked at him and said, what are you talking about? He says, it's a feeling I have. So I told Tapp that story, and he said the only person to get him off is Doc Lewis, if Schlumberg agrees to go see him. And he didn't want to see him. He says, I'll go. On the morning of the 14th, I said, just stick on my wing. They're going to broadcast the code word Ohio before we ever get to the target. Nobody heard the code word. We got to where we have to drop our exterior tanks. We dropped the tanks. We went in and strafed airfields around Tokyo. We were getting shot at. I know you could see the tracers. But when somebody had only 90 gallons of gas left, we needed 90 gallons to get back to Iwo Jima. They called in 90 gallons. And I'm leading a flight of four, and I'm leading my flight of four through some clouds towards the B-29 that's going to navigate us back to Iwo Jima. When I came out of the clouds, Schlumberger was gone. There was no radio contact, no visible contact. And he was the last guy killed in World War II. While we were strafing Japan, they declared the war over. And it was 3 hours before we got back. So he was really the last man killed on a mission of hostility towards the Japanese on August 14th, 1945. Phil Schlumberger graduated from university at the age of 16 and entered the Air Corps at the age on his 18th, and he took the IQ test, and his IQ test score was the highest ever scored of any of the 16 million of us that entered World War II. He was bright and brilliant and a good pilot, and he knew he was going to die, refused not to go, and went and was killed.
One of the more than 406,000 Americans who made the ultimate sacrifice in World War II, and not the only one to pay that price in the final days of the war. Mickey Gannich will turn 101 in a few months. His frequent speeches to Americans young and old often focus on December 7, 1941. The young sailor was in football pads aboard the USS Pennsylvania, preparing for a game against the team from the USS Arizona. That game, of course, never happened, and Gannich was fortunate to survive the attack on Pearl Harbor. His ship wasn't seriously damaged again the rest of the war until the final days, 75 years ago this week, off of Okinawa.
Something happened August 6th of 1945, it dropped an atomic bomb on Hiroshima. 3 days later, August 9th, it dropped an atomic bomb on Nagasaki. 3 days later, August 12th, we got in Okinawa. All the other ships are in there. We anchored in there. 8:30 that night, Japanese plane came on with its lights on. Nobody fired a shot at it. They thought it's a friendly plane. Aimed its torpedo at the coast of the big ship it saw. Battleship Pennsylvania. The living compartment, the quartermaster's, is back by the rudder, back by the propellers. That's where the living compartment was. Half hour before that, I went up the bridge. I was going to write a letter to one of my sisters. 8:30 at night, when that Japanese plane came in, launched that torpedo, it hit the propellers back there. Everything went in and up. The living compartment, the quartermaster's, that 26 quartermaster's, I lost 20 of them that night. The next morning, Japanese asked for peace. We're trying to stay afloat while we signed the peace treaty in Tokyo Bay. They told us in the shallow ground, so if we sink, we'd just sink in the mud. We was able to stay afloat. We got hit at Pearl Harbor, never got hit again until the night before Japanese asked for peace.
And if I'm understanding you correctly, had you not gone above to write the letter to your sister, you would have been in there where the torpedo hit.
Yeah. I forgot I had other plans for me there, too.
And in this case, those 20 men who were killed were guys you had come to know very well.
I knew them. I knew them by their first names there. And being on the ship there and knowing them by their first names, they worked for me, and I knew them. And one of my jobs is to identify bodies and parts of bodies here. I hope I never have to go through something like that again, identifying by the clothing, the stencils on their clothing and names there, trying to identify them and collect their gear and send it home to their families. In fact, one of my first class, the one that was next one under me, I took his clothes back to his folks back in Wisconsin there. Mm. That was hard to do.
I can't imagine anything more difficult. I mean, what do you say in a situation like that?
And when the ship got torpedoed there at Okinawa, it sunk so far down in the back part of the ship where you could step right on the water. Four bodies were recovered that morning. First thing, divers went down and pulled the guys over close. I grabbed a hold of one guy's arm and I pulled his arm back out of his socket. That's awfully hard to do.
And when it's so close to the end of the war.
Yeah.
How should those guys be remembered all these years later?
By treating each other like they treated you. They were alive. We had treated each other respectfully, lovingly. Try to be friends with everybody. I think with them, that would be a plus if the people would know it.
You know, and I've talked to so many veterans for whom VJ Day was a day of celebration, and they were excited. Here, the war is finally over. But it sounds like for your ship, that must have been bittersweet considering what had just happened.
Yeah. It told us to Guam, which is the war's over. They already signed it. We're still sitting there. And it told us to Guam there. And during the period from Okinawa to Guam, because there's a floating dry dock down there, it told us that three tugs pulled us there because we didn't have any power at that time. So the war was, the peace treaty was being signed. We got in Guam, put us in a floating dry dock and recovered many we can of the bodies and all. And we got patched up and they sent us back to the States. The war is over. They sent back to the States. We got about 300-400 miles east of Guam. Well, we had to, when the torpedo hit, it wiped out the propellers on the right side. One on the left side was good and one was not so good. About 300-400 miles east of Guam there, we started having problems with the propeller. So we stopped the ship. We were all by ourselves. The war is over there, and everybody else went in their different directions there. We stopped the ship, put divers on the other side, see what they could do. Because in all big ships, you have divers. We put divers on the other side, see what they can do with that propeller. Meantime, sharks were attracted by parts of bodies that are still on the ship there. We pulled the divers out of the water, put boats in the water with the Marines there with rifles to keep the sharks away from the divers so they could work on the propeller. So we came back to the States by ourselves with one propeller out of four.
And if they hadn't been able to repair that one, what would have happened to you guys? You were dead in the water, huh?
We'd be out there like the Indianapolis, the one that took the atomic bomb there to Tinian for bombing over Japan there. We'd been in bad shape, but fortunes of the war, I guess, well, that's what you'd call it. And this was September 2nd, they signed a peace treaty in on the Missouri in Tokyo Bay. So it's quite a relief now we can get back to normal there if we can. And think about what happened there and think about the future, what's going to happen.
Here in 2020, the not-so-distant future, we'll see our military's top brass once again on the USS Missouri as they commemorate the 75th anniversary of the signing of the surrender aboard that mighty Mo. That'll happen in Pearl Harbor on September 2nd. The realities of the COVID-19 era will limit how many people can be there in person, but there will be a live stream of that ceremony, of a special Warbird flyover, and a few other events in the days leading up to it. So make a note of that. Head over to hometownheroesradio.com if you want to explore some more information on that. And join us again next time here on the radio when we're reminded again through the stories of our veterans that on VJ Day and every day, our freedom is not free.